Welcome to Season 1 of Disability Bandwidth,
a show where we talk with disability leaders each week about career, life, and technology. I'm Nikki Nolan.
And I'm Sam Prue.
Let's get started.
Can you please introduce yourself?
So my name is Jennison Asuncion, pronouns he, him. I am Filipino, black hair, dark eyes, and I'm right now wearing, I'm overdressed for a Sunday. I'm wearing a button-down, striped, short-sleeve shirt, collared. I am head of accessibility engineering evangelism at LinkedIn, but I am also co-founder and vice chair of the GAD Foundation.
Tell us a little bit about GAD. What is GAD?
So GAD is Global Accessibility Awareness Day, and it's something that honestly, it just happened by fluke. I had been doing a lot of outreach and advocacy. This is back in 2010, 2011, and just trying to figure out different ways to make accessibility interesting and quote unquote accessible to mainstream designers and developers. So I started something called Accessibility Camp in Toronto, where I spent a lot of years. So I consider that my hometown. And it was some random November, Saturday in November of 2011, that I just happened to be trolling Twitter. I happened to be home and I was on Twitter and I saw an automatically generated tweet by someone who I didn't know at the time named Joe Devin, who was at that time a developer in Los Angeles, also Canadian, by the way. But anyway, long story short, he wrote a blog post that essentially he threw down the gauntlet and said, we need a global accessibility day for developers so that they could at least understand the fundamentals. And he, where this all came from was his dad was getting older and his sight was deteriorating and so was his hearing. So using the phone to contact his bank was impossible. And Joe thought that maybe using the website would be easier, but that also was problematic. So as most people in tech do when they get a bee in their bonnet, Joe Devin took to his blog and wrote this blog post, and which I subsequently read. And remember, I mentioned that I was already doing things and thinking about ways to get accessibility more out front in the mainstream. So I contacted him and I said, say, hey, if you're interested in this, let's see if we can do it. And in May 9th, 2012, we launched the first Global Accessibility Awareness Day, and we celebrated our 10th anniversary this past year. Yeah, it was one of those weird, like, you just never expect those things to happen. I mean, you couldn't find two people who shouldn't have organized such a massive event just because we're too busy for our own good. But the fact that people actually took to it and owned it and kind of, well, we're 10 years, right? We just did our 10th. And Joe and I just step back every year and go, oh my goodness, like, look at all of this.
It's always nice to hear a story about grassroots activism and empowerment and the good things that can come out of these things, because too often all we hear is some of the less great things that have come out of social media and grassroots organizing.
No, and if I could just say, I mean, just back to your point, one of the things that I love most about my job is, you know, being here in the Silicon Valley is one thing, but just the fact that I end up working with, you know, some amazing folks who end up going to do amazing things outside of LinkedIn, and I stay in touch with them. And, you know, I even this past week, I got a message from someone who I worked with like 3-4 years ago. And they approached me because they are starting to kick up accessibility and wanted me to chat with their company. And I just, to me, like, obviously my first and foremost objective, intent, all that good stuff is the work that I do at LinkedIn. But the fact that I've had the opportunity to meet and stay in touch with engineers and designers who've moved on and who still understand the importance of accessibility, I think to me, that's what makes my job so important. And it obviously comes with a great level of responsibility, you know, in just in terms of how I position accessibility to people who have never dealt with it before, like we're dealing with it for the first time. So just wanted to shout out to Vivian. She's one of my favorite people. And as a design person, you know, most of the biggest issues and challenges that come up happen in design. So if we're able to get designers like Vivian and others to think about accessibility, then we're shifting left.
Absolutely. I mean, I speak to so many design conferences. I think I am at more design conferences than I am at accessibility conferences, which is super interesting. Because if we can get the designers to include it, the developers will build it. But if accessibility isn't in the design, the developers aren't going to think to add it afterward.
And it's great, Sam. I mean, props to you, because I'm seeing you all over the place. And the fact that you are speaking to designers in their own conferences, I mean, don't get me wrong, I live and breathe accessibility, and it's important for us to attend and be part of those quote-unquote accessibility-centric events. I run one, so I know the value. We also need to be presenting at design-specific conferences, engineering-specific conferences. Otherwise, we end up preaching to the choir. We need to be speaking to people who this might be a new topic for them, or it might be a topic that they're not comfortable with.
I think one of the things that I don't want to say, you know, is bothersome, but maybe you find the same thing sometimes where you're speaking to a crowd and you suddenly realize this might be the only contact they have with someone with a disability this year.
Right. Oh no, absolutely. Absolutely.
So I'm a designer, and tell me sort of about what you see as being the downstream impacts of accessibility not being a part of the process and just being an engineering part.
Well, you don't want engineers to be interpreting everything on their own. And that's why, and you folks, you probably do this, Nikki, or know about this, but just like something as simple as annotating your designs, so that the engineers aren't left guessing, like what is this UI element supposed to be, or what it should be called, or what is the keyboard interaction supposed to be on this particular screen. You know, don't get me wrong, engineers are amazingly smart individuals, but there's a reason why there's designers there. Designers own the user experience. Designers understand, and they kind of are the architects behind like what a person should be doing when they're interacting with a screen or with the process. And so the downstream effect for all of this being left up to engineers is just that. You are leaving engineers up to guessing what the real intent is with there.
I mean, I don't know if it's a thing, but working at LinkedIn, you have probably noticed it. When designers do include accessibility annotations and keyboard designs and things like this, does it then lead to better management of accessibility? Because too often we have this thing we're trying to battle, right? Where, well, it's not accessible yet, but we got a release on September 19th. And so we're releasing anyway, accessible or not, we can fix it later. Whereas if the accessibility requirements are built in from the beginning, do you find that more often it's built into the product management timeline?
Well, absolutely. Yeah. So when you have the annotations in the spec, an engineer, for example, can at least factor in any additional estimates in terms of any extra things that they need to do to create the accessibility. Now, don't get me wrong, obviously we want them to be thinking about accessibility up front, but not every engineer has received accessibility training. But at least if they've gotten the annotations and some notes, they have something to start with. They're not having to guess what they need to do and how long it might take them. So absolutely, having accessibility in the user requirements will then, at the beginning, turn the light on for the designer to say, oh yeah, so this is a requirement, so then I will add the annotations. And then similarly, when they hand over the annotated spec to the engineer goes, okay, there's accessibility stuff in here which I need to tend to and to consider when I'm making my estimates and when I'm actually doing development.
I was just going to say, and then it turns that into, from the project management perspective, instead of not doing a thing that you already saw as an extra, it turns it into a conscious decision of we are not going to meet this specified requirement.
So that's sort of like a perfect world that people actually have knowledge about these things. If you are at the very beginning, or your company isn't doing accessibility, or they're not including people with disabilities into their thought process or their system? What are some things both of you have sort of seen to like build this system?
Well, for me in my role, so I, part of my role is owning training across our engineering orgs for, so for our web, iOS and Android engineers. That's one piece of it. The other, so that's the, you know, monthly trainings that we offer, all that kind of stuff. But then there's also the day-to-day stuff. So we have office hours every day where engineers and designers can bring their mocks or their builds in to meet with someone who works for me, who will be able to spot some of the big blocking items and such. So it requires, because unfortunately, we're not at a point yet where folks who are studying computer science, engineering, and design are not getting accessibility training, whether it's in boot camps or at their college or university. It's happening like in small pockets here and there, but it's not happening to the point where you are graduating computer science, engineering, and design students having any level of accessibility knowledge. It's always just by luck that that happens. And certainly at LinkedIn, you know, I asked, the question is asked when people enroll to training, have you taken training before? And you can imagine the balance of people have never taken accessibility training ever before they come to us. And so that's great on the one hand, but then that just means, you know, you can train someone, but how much of that's going to stick and all of that kind of stuff? And how much do we train them? Because we're not going to be able to train them on everything. That's just impossible. But yeah, I'm not sure, Sam, in your role, how much you get to do in terms of the training with at companies and stuff.
I do some, but a lot of what I do is focused on getting buy-in and getting people to get it. I find the individual designers, developers, engineers all want to do the right thing, right? But one thing I struggle with, and I wonder how you feel about it, is whether or not grassroots accessibility activism in a company works well. Because if the CEO and the CTO and the CFO and the higher-ups and the directors and the VPs are on board with accessibility, they will offer their folks training, they'll put it in requirements, they'll budget for it, they'll resource it, they'll do all their stuff, right?
I think you just hit the nail on the head, is the budgeting. I mean, at the end of the day, you need leadership support in order to invest in accessibility. And that's all a bunch of different things. It could be test automation. It could be basic. It could be something as fundamental as bodies dedicated to accessibility. You can't do accessibility successfully if that's only like if you have one person who 40% of their time is spent on accessibility. That's going to be impossible to do. You need at least one person who's doing this full time, and someone who understands how to navigate around, someone who is comfortable talking to an engineer, but is equally as comfortable talking to an executive. And that those are different skill sets. I mean, someone, I see all kinds of job descriptions because I share them through A11Y Jobs, the Twitter account that I run. I've been doing that since 2012. And the last couple of years has seen such an increase in job opportunities. But I look at some of the job descriptions and I shake my head because what I see are companies, many of whom are starting their journey on accessibility, and they're looking for this superstar who can not only code and figure out what's wrong with a JavaScript instance, who can also make a presentation to an executive. Like those are two totally different skills. You're not going to find someone who has all of that. So I worry that in fact, despite maybe best everyone wanting to do the right thing, you're almost setting people up for failure if you're expecting them to have all this stuff. And don't even get me started about, you know, recruiting and how recruiters are not trained on how to hire accessibility people. I just hear this. I hear stories from people who've asked me before and after they've done interviews, like they've relayed to me stories. So we still have a lot of work to do there as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's why at Fable and what I do, like it's very interesting to me how you and I mean, my day job title is also accessibility evangelist, kind of share that title. And are approaching it kind of from the two different sides of the same table and meeting somewhere in the middle, because too often I hear from individual designers and developers who say, I want to build accessible products and I wish my company was building accessible products, but the higher ups in the company are not not bought in yet. And so it kind of hurts, but sometimes I have to tell them, well, we've got to work on executive engagement because you can't do this by yourself.
It's honestly like, it's just because sometimes, and I'll say this as diplomatically as I can here, but sometimes, when you do get pushback, you need someone upstairs to help with that conversation and to help those who are pushing back understand the commitment and understand things. I'm definitely not one about who lives off of titles or anything, but sometimes it does make a difference, particularly if you have a VP or if you have someone at that level who is a champion of accessibility or who is a sponsor. I just don't know any other way. I mean, grassroots is great, but then at the end of the day, if you only have grassroots, then that you have a more likelihood of accessibility becoming deprioritized, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I mean, it's about sincere engagement, right? Not just checking the boxes. I mean, sometimes the paranoid in me looks at some of these jobs and I think, are they being intentionally set up to fail?
Yeah.
Right? Does a company want to say, oh, we tried to do accessibility and we couldn't. Right. So therefore, we don't have to do it anymore.
What are some tactics that you take to engage people that are higher up in the company? Is there things that you've seen work?
Honestly, for me, it's, call me ballsy or whatnot. but for me, I'll just reach out directly and engage in a conversation. And maybe part of it's because I've been at LinkedIn as long as I have. Like, I've known a number of folks who have risen through the ranks since I've been there. So from that perspective, that's actually been interesting, I have to say, because when I first came to LinkedIn, I probably spent the first couple of years just getting to know people and gaining the trust and also building the relationships. That's so important to have those relationships. And those were with like engineers and designers who, a few years later are climbing up the ranks. And before you know it, they're senior managers, they're engineering managers, they might be directors or whatever. But they are involved in conversations that I certainly am not involved with. But then I can go to them and go, hey, like, what's happening with accessibility here? And it's so important for those of us who work in accessibility to be able to build that trust and those relationships. It's one of those things that it's not taught in Accessibility 101, is the importance not only of that, but then also of negotiation and things like that. Because as much as we want to make everything accessible all the time, every day, it's unfortunately, we're not there yet. And so there's always going to be sometimes where you're going to have to negotiate or, this thing, we'll get it out in 2 weeks, and you're going to have to weigh the pros and cons of picking up a battle.
And even more so in the industry now. And I wonder if you've noticed it and how you handle it. We are having to tell people things that they don't necessarily want to hear or that they wish weren't true. Like that a $50 subscription to something that you put on your website won't solve all of your accessibility problems, or that you're not exempt from a certain compliance thing, even though, there's so much various and types of false information floating around as the industry grows.
The other myth is, well, here we made this thing accessible and we're done. It's not a one and done thing. There's also maintenance and there's what if, my biggest fear is always whenever I see messages about, we're unraveling our new design or our new thing and come, I'm like, oh gosh, like they invested so much in the previous design. I'm worried to see what might have happened like with this new thing or the new version because they might not have necessarily thought about accessibility. Now, there's a lot more accessibility-minded companies out there, but then we all know we've heard the statistic from the WebAIM survey, 97% of websites out there still have like egregious accessibility errors.
Yeah, it's the trust. That's so important, isn't it? When you have to give someone bad news, right? Yeah, like, hey, as we approach the midpoint of this amazing episode, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor.
Hello, my name is Ted. I am a full-time screen reader and switch input or alternative navigation user. I am a member of Fable's community of accessibility testers. If you're listening to this podcast, you know just how important it is to integrate the voices of people with disabilities into every aspect of your accessibility journey. Fable can help you do that. From improving your accessibility training with Fable Upskill to working directly with assistive technology users with Fable Engage, we can help you take the next step in your accessibility journey. For more information, visit our website at makeitfable.com.
Now that we've heard from our sponsor, let's continue the interview.
So both of you are Canadian. Mm-hmm. Both of you work in between sort of Canada and the United States. In terms of accessibility, what are sort of the differences that you've seen and similarities?
We'll start with the positive. The similarities, you know, there is a trans-border care and wanting to make things accessible. So we'll get that out of the way. I would say the biggest difference that I've seen is despite the AODA, the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act, and other legislation in Canada and all that stuff, it's still rare for me to see and to be able to promote a job description for someone working on accessibility in Canada at a major company. It is so rare. And when I do, it's typically the usual folks. I come from banking, so I'll say, yeah, it's either banking or telco, like highly regulated places. But we have, Canada is known for its tech. It's very innovative. We've got Waterloo, we've got Toronto, we've got Vancouver and Montreal, really big tech centers. And yes, there are others, but those are the big ones that come to mind right away. But show me people who are working on accessibility in these places, and show me where are the hiring? Where is it happening? Is it all happening in this dark, underbelly of where people just find out about jobs? To me, that is pretty telling of the difference between Canada and the U.S. is the number of folks who are engaged full time at companies on accessibility in accessibility roles. It is changing slowly. I'm seeing a few more jobs, but certainly not as many as I would have expected, particularly with AODA and all the other talk that we hear in Canada about how much inclusion of people with disabilities matters. Well, if it matters so much, where is this all happening? Because I'm not seeing it.
Why is that, do you think?
I don't know, man. Honestly, the only thing I could think of is either it's not on the radar enough, or the people with disability, like Canadians with disabilities, you know, is it that stereotype that we're too polite to do anything or to say anything?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard theories that it's because lawsuits in Canada are not as viable.
Right, and they take forever, right? If you file a Canadian human rights complaint, you could be doing that forever.
Right. But in a lawsuit, right, you don't necessarily, loser doesn't necessarily pay legal costs.
Right.
So, you know, that makes that less viable. But I mean, in my heart, I wonder, I mean, the litigious, strong legal framework in the United States has gotten accessibility done, but it's come with some side effects.
Oh, there's definitely unintended consequences. But, you know, without it, there would have been do you know what I mean? Without it, there'd be nothing. But I look at the AODA and I'm too far away from it to know how everything's working now, but I'm not sure how punitive the AODA is and whether it is easy enough for, you know, a Joe or Joanne in Sudbury to complain about website not being accessible for a large company. And I'm not sure what the regulations are. I haven't heard anything about someone filing an AODA, whatever, a claim or something. And I just, like I said, for me, it's not to see that. And then again, not to see that many jobs at all in accessibility. I think that's telling to me about what corporate Canada, that they don't see this as a priority. That's the only thing I can think of as to why that's the case. They just don't see it as a priority.
I'm going to transition into a new question, which I feel like is in the similar line, but maybe totally off in left field. What has sort of been your biggest frustration in your career? And is it still happening?
My biggest frustration in my career.
I'm glad you're not just saying Canada. No, I'm kidding.
I guess the biggest frustration is what I mentioned before, the fact that as much progress as we've made, we haven't. We're still at 97% of all websites still having accessibility issues. Even as much as we have people, you know, getting involved in Global Accessibility Awareness Day and working in accessibility. And even despite all the lawsuits and everything that's gone on, we still have this depressing number. And so I think for me, that's still a frustration, because why is it that we have not been able to make more progress? And I mean, I have ideas and I have thoughts around why, but there's just like, it just seems like we make a little bit of progress every year. Now, all that said, it's all important and impactful progress, but it's still not enough. And like, how do we go from 97% to maybe like 70% and then 50%? And like, how do we bring that number down? So I think that to me is a frustration in my career.
It's telling, isn't it, that 75% of websites inaccessible would be a win.
We gotta go down, right? Like, I'm not gonna be unrealistic and say we're gonna go from 97 to zero.
You can't say you have some ideas and drop a teaser like that. Come on now. And
we still need to create tools, authoring tools, because okay, let's face it, the balance of websites out there are all owned by or done by people who probably don't know anything about web development or web design. They're small mom and pop shops who are using website building tools, or they just get the cheapest designer or developing agency that they can and just say, put something up. They're not thinking about accessibility or anything like that. They just want to get their stuff out there. So we need to do better job and better work in getting some of those web in a box tools and the mobile tools. That's another frustration I have. We spend so much time talking about web accessibility. We've kind of moved on and like, we need to obviously care about web accessibility, don't get me wrong, but I don't see enough focus put on mobile. And mobile is kind of like, mobile is such a big thing already. Like we're years behind, I think, in terms of the amount of focus. But getting back to the first thing, yeah, we need more tools, more mainstream tools that have accessibility built in. We need to make it easy for the average Joe or Joanne to develop an accessible site. Right now, there's limited number of themes. For example, if you use WordPress or any of those other things, the number of themes is low. So if you want to be creative or whatnot, you're kind of like left with only a certain number of themes to use. So we need to get better at that. So the authoring tools, we need to, from a holistic perspective, thinking about it like from a broader, like strategic way, we need to be teaching students. So there's an organization called Teach Access, which I'm involved with. And we have a mission now by 2030 to have 1 million college, university, and bootcamp students be exposed to accessibility. And it just, things like that are just so important, because it also normalizes accessibility in the conversation. It, you know, if everyone graduates from school with some level of knowledge about accessibility, that also means they understand that there are actually people with disabilities out there. Mm-hmm. And visible and non-visible disabilities, right? The full spectrum of things. So those are some of the areas where I think things need, those accessibility could be, you know, interlaced in it. And the stuff we're thinking of, we're planning with the GAD Foundation, we're hoping will also help to that end as well.
Yeah, I mean, awareness is so critical. It's surprising to me as a screen reader user how often to this day, despite screen readers having been around since 1978, do I get the, oh, blind people can use computers?
Yeah.
What?
Right?
What?
Yeah, it's not just me. You get that too, don't you?
Oh, yeah. And the fact that web accessibility guidelines have been around since 1998, people still go, what? Like, oh, there's guidelines? So yeah, there's a whole set of things, but I also worry there's all kinds of technology out there that I see today that I'm like, oof. I mean, there's a lot of amazing work now being done at the grassroots level with mixed MR, mixed reality and AR, all of those things, VR, XR Access is a great resource for people to check out on that front. But there's stuff like just as simple as like, this might sound trivial, but I love going to Vegas for the food. But it's sad to say that I cannot no longer really use most slot machines in casinos.
Why?
Because they're all touchscreen.
Really? Wow.
And even if they have the handle, you still have to set up like how many coins you want in each pull. And those are all done through touchscreen.
Wow.
So It's we're getting to this point, and I know there's a lot more touchscreens everywhere in elevators. I just had an interesting experience at an unnamed hotel last weekend where I checked out early because they had touchscreens inside the elevator for the floor buttons to be pressed. I know the other elevators where you push something outside, those have accessibility features, but this type of thing, these had a telephone style keypad on the right hand side, and I only found that by accident. So on the left and right, there were touchscreens, but then the telephone keypad did not work consistently in each elevator. So I either had a choice between waiting for, like, having to wait to figure out which elevator would work, or call the front desk and ask someone to give me a hand just to get to my floor. And in my years of travel, that was the first time that I'd been confronted by that level of inaccessibility. And it was just, all they had to do was just, like, could they not be checking their keypads like once a month to see if they actually worked?
I mean, I never forget the elevator I rode in that what was a touchscreen. All the buttons were touchscreen, and they had put Braille on the touchscreen, which is not... No, I don't quite know the thought process there. It was pretty...
But did it work?
Well, no, because every time you tried to read the Braille, you'd be touching the number.
Oh, okay.
My God. Right? You know, something that's wild. You know, something that's interesting. So we interviewed Sherry as well, and she was noting that things used to be more accessible. Back in the day, technology actually used to be more accessible. And as we're like migrating into some of these digital interfaces, like that it's becoming more inaccessible and more unusable. And that's, you know, something I just want to ask, like, because I'm super curious, what was like your first piece of technology you remember using, and what did you use it for?
The first piece of technology that I can vividly remember was using a computer without a screen reader, and basically having family members, my cousins and my sister being my screen reader. This was way back in the day, but learning, like, creating games in BASIC and just having to read the screen to me to tell me what was going on or if I was getting errors. Because I think at the time I was just trying to play musical sounds and stuff, but I would always like, if I had errors that would pop up, since I didn't have a screen reader, I would have to ask for help.
Something about BASIC. It seems to be in the Sherry mentioned it. I've mentioned it. You've mentioned it. I don't know.
Yeah. But then there's like fun stuff like a compass, a Braille compass, and like a Braille watch. Things like that were also things that I remember. But I remember my first screen reader was on an Apple IIc, and the worst sounding robotic screen reading voice, but it opened up a world of stuff.
I think that people just don't realize that, like, when things are inaccessible, they really prevent people from just living independent lives.
Well, yeah, like, and I'll say, like, that slot machine example, as trivial as it may sound, I mean, people go to Vegas to gamble, right? And so, like, why wouldn't someone with a disability also want to gamble?
Yeah,
like, it's silly.
Yeah, although, I mean, I don't know, I don't understand the design thinking behind a touch screen slot machine. I mean, the gears were half the fun, right?
Yeah. No, absolutely.
It's probably a data capture thing. I don't know. I'm just like going into like the deep, dirty thoughts of like, what would be the point of...
Yeah. What it was is that they were all mechanical. And so it was very, very difficult for the casinos to control the exact payout rate.
Yeah.
Whereas now they can change it depending on the time of day and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. I'm surprised no one has actually taken a casino on... litigious route around that.
I'm also surprised nobody has just built, there must be one somewhere, like just with all the old slot machines from like the 40s and 50s, like,
yeah
kind of, you know, like they have those for like arcades and that would be fun.
But then my pushback on that would be, you know, some of the more bougie casinos, like why shouldn't we be able to go and play in those ones as well, right? I would say with the more flashy slot machines.
I don't know, I'm just, maybe it's my own biases, but it's bringing me back to the thing I always say, which is that accessible things are better things, right?
For the user.
In this case, an accessible slot machine is better because it's more fun and because the casino can't control the payouts too exactly.
Why wouldn't they want my money?
Yep, exactly.
That seems like a really good trend. Like I've seen this all over Twitter. I've seen this all over the places. It's like when you make things also inaccessible, you're losing out on a market. You're losing out on money. And like, I know a lot of the time people try to argue things like, oh, like you should make things accessible as like a feel good, like you're, you know, excluding people, but also like you're missing a major demographic of that your product can no longer cannot serve. You can't get their money. I know this is like gross. But,
here's your, you make a great point. And the fact that hotel lost $280 last weekend because I didn't stay that extra night. It might be a little thing, but there actually is another major hotel chain that I don't stay at because I can't even book on their website.
And the other thing we don't talk about, right? How many of our friends and family members are we taking along with us, right? Yeah. We don't go to casinos and hotels alone and restaurants and all this stuff.
So we went into like your biggest frustrations within your career. What do you feel like has been your biggest successes?
I brought it up before, but I love talking about it. And it's the longer term investment that's paying off in terms of like the engineers and designers that I'm working with at LinkedIn, who, like I say, move on to bigger things. I'm not going to say they're better, but they're bigger, maybe, to other companies. And they still take their curiosity or their passion for accessibility that they might have only gotten at LinkedIn and exposure to it. And they're bringing it to other companies. And I think to me, that has been and continues to be my something that I'm most proud of in my career, you know, because the other stuff is a given, you know. It obviously, there's always great pleasure out of launching stuff that's accessible and all of that stuff. But it's these other intangibles, the out of the blue message that I'll get, like I said, from engineer X or designer Y, who's now established at their company and they want to take forward accessibility, or they found out that accessibility is a thing at their company and they're raising their hand and they just want to know like some tips and tricks.
What are some myths around disability that you really would love to bust?
There's so many. Let's see. That only, like if we're just talking about like accessibility type of myths, that one of them is that only people who are blind use screen reading software, which is a myth. There's people with a variety of different cognitive and learning disabilities who also use different screen reading technology. So that's one big myth. Let's see. Sam, what's one of your favorite myths?
Oh boy, there are so many.
And it doesn't have to be around accessibility. It could just be around disability as well. I want to make sure that it's open enough to explore that possibility of the world too.
I mean, one of the things about myths, do you ever get this feeling where they are so pervasive that it feels like you're doing a whack-a-mole thing?
Yeah.
Like we talk about it, or we hear some major organization talk about it every year, and every year there's a scene on TV where a blind person touches someone's face.
Yes.
Every year. Yes, and we talk about it, and we usually mention the specific program every year, but like next year this one's coming around again. I mean, the strategy? How should we be busting these myths?
Right? No, that the face. Yeah. Well, and the other one is every blind person reads Braille.
Mm-hmm.
There's a myth.
Mm-hmm. It should be true. Well, no. Let me say, it would be, if possible, it would be good if more blind people.
Oh no, absolutely. I'm a big Braille evangelist myself. But the reality is, unfortunately, not everyone has been exposed to it. But you always get, like when I fly, sometimes a flight attendant will come by and go, oh, would you like the Braille, this and that? And I'm like, I usually take it just to take it because I think that it needs to be dusted off once in a while. Mm-hmm. So it's never been pulled out of its bin. So let's take it out. But I worry because not every blind person can read Braille. So it's not only going to be helpful to a certain segment.
Reminds me of the waitress I got once who asked me if I wanted the embroidered menu.
Embroidered?
She meant Braille, but it was pretty good.
I've also heard similar things like not everybody who is deaf, you know, has sign language.
Yeah, that's another good one.
Yeah, there's so many things that people just assume and has been trained into us through like ableist media or things like that.
And one of my favorites, so I fly fairly frequently. There's a tongue twister. And there's this moment, and Sam, you've probably experienced this too, when you either walk off an airplane or get to the ticket counter. I ask for assistance because I'm not going to figure out how to get around an airport in the brief amount of time that I want to be in there. But typically someone shows up with a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
What?
And there's this uncomfortable 30-second conversation that happens, which is, I don't use a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. And you hope 9 times out of 10 people will get it. And they'll be like, okay. And they'll put the wheelchair on the side and you'll go off in your merry way. But there's these other, there's that one time out of that 9 times out of 10 where it could become like this heated discussion and all kinds of stuff where they're like, get in the wheelchair, or you should use a wheelchair, or it will be easier in the wheelchair.
What really bugs me is when there's an enormous terminal and you have about 4 minutes to make your transfer, and you've got your suitcase and you've got your cane and you've got your thing and you've got your this. And sometimes you just don't have time to argue about the wheelchair and you just get in it because you have to make your flight.
Yeah. And I mean, people need to understand a wheelchair is that's a personal piece of equipment that people who cannot or who have trouble walking use. Sam and I can't see. We can walk. So yeah, it's just, it's, I don't know if that's more of a myth or if that's just more ignorance. Sorry, I went on a bit of a
no, that makes sense. Thing. No, it makes sense that like people confuse a lot of the disabilities. And I have been working with a coach who is a person who's blind, and I know people have different ways that they even want to be identified. Like I like to be identified disability first. So I'm like a neurodiverse person or a neurodivergent person, but I know that everybody is like different.
Right.
So we have about a few minutes left. Is there anything we didn't cover that you would like to talk about?
Absolutely. Real quick, I'd like to talk about the GAD Foundation. And if people want to learn more about it, you can go to GAD.foundation. And essentially what this was is Joe and I kept hearing every year, we need to have some sort of like, there has to be something more sustaining after the actual day of GAD and stuff like that. So we'd been thinking about starting up a foundation for a while, but we figured we'd wait for our 10th anniversary to do it. And so here we are. And our mission really is to disrupt the culture of the process of digital product design and technology design in general in such a way that accessibility becomes a first-class citizen, or it becomes an automatic requirement. And how we're doing that, we have different programs that we're going to be doing. We already have something called the GAD Pledge, which is an opportunity for, typically it's an open source coding project. So React Native took the GAD Pledge in 2020. And this past year, that was before we launched the foundation, but in this past year, the Ember JavaScript project took the GAD Pledge. And what it is it's an opportunity. These open source libraries power a lot of technologies out there. React Native was for mobile, and Ember.js is web. But they power a lot of the websites out there. So if we can get a lot of these open source frameworks to integrate accessibility into their widgets, but not only that, but to create documentation on how to use their widgets accessibly, we're gonna help move that 97% needle. So that's one of the programs. Another program, which I'll highlight here, is something called the GAD Speakers Fund. And that's gonna be something we're gonna launch. We're not launching it today, but it's gonna be launched in the coming years. Is it's going to be an opportunity to, we want to further the conversation between accessibility folks and mainstream everyday tech folks. And insofar as if you're an everyday engineer or designer and you get a speaking gig at an accessibility conference, this is in the days when we'll be traveling back in person, not everyone can afford to do that. And so we're going to be providing, essentially, it's almost like a scholarship for that to happen. So, and then also for accessibility folks, say that you get accepted at a large conference like or event like a South by Southwest. It's not cheap to go to those types of events. So we will make it possible financially for people to do that. And why we want to do that is because we want cross-pollination. We want your everyday engineer or designer to be able to attend an accessibility specific event so that they can not only get exposed to the topic and have the conversation and give their talk at that event, but not only that, but they can also meet people, including people with disabilities and vice versa. You know, those of us who work in accessibility kind of live in our own little echo chamber sometimes, and we always present to and talk to our friends and people who we know will be receptive to, or who might know a little bit or care about accessibility. But what this fund will allow is for us to be able to present at events that might not be accessibility specific. But again, it's about furthering the conversation, which is what GAD is about. It's about furthering that conversation. So look forward to that in the next, probably the next year and a half, we'll launch that. And if you want to, again, GAD.foundation, if you want to learn about all the kind of stuff that we're hoping to endeavor on.
This has been a great conversation. So much covered and so much that we could cover if only we had another hour. But unfortunately, we don't. So speaking of continuing the conversation and furthering the conversation, if folks want to find you and get in touch or follow your work and keep up with what you're doing, where can they find you?
They can find me on Twitter, and I have an easy one, at Jennison. So that's J-E-N-N-I-S-O-N. I also tweet jobs with A11Y jobs and A11Y events for accessibility related events. And if you're so inclined, you can also follow me on LinkedIn. You can just search for me under Jennison Assumption, and you can see the spelling of that in the podcast in the podcast notes. Yeah. But thank you so much. This has been great.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Disability Bandwidth. If you like this episode of Disability Bandwidth, please subscribe and share it with friends and family. Today's episode was hosted by Sam Prue and Nikki Nolan. Edited and produced by Nikki Nolan. Transcripts are written by Emma Klauber. Theme music is created by F.A. Ackman. Special thanks to everyone at Fable who, without their support, this show would not be possible. You can find out more about Disability Bandwidth on Twitter and Instagram @DisabilityBandwidth. Or on our website at disabilitybandwidth.com.